we made clear to them that we take this matter with respect to Mr. Khashoggi very seriously.
Tough talk from the U.S. regarding disappeared journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It's Friday, October 19th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead today, Reuters rioters prevent women from entering a Hindu temple. Traffickers target Rohingya refugees and hunting for the perfect pumpkin. It's all ahead today on VOA Asia. The U.S. appears willing to give Saudi Arabia more time to finish its investigation into Turkish allegations that Saudi agents killed a U.S.-based journalist inside Riyadh's consulate in Istanbul. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, after meeting with Saudi and Turkish leaders this week, briefed President Donald Trump at the White House on Thursday. He told him to give Saudi Arabia a few more days to complete its investigation into the disappearance of the writer Jamal Khashoggi. International Edition's Laurie London spoke with Haider Amir, visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, who grew up in Saudi Arabia and knew Jamal Khashoggi.
First and foremost, if what is reported is true, even if a good portion of what is reported is true, it's obviously in the first instance a tragedy for Jamal Khashoggi and his family. It is also, it's obviously a tragedy for journalists, but it's also a tragedy for Saudi Arabia. In many ways, Saudi Arabia has been undertaking very important, very needed, very positive reforms, allowing women the right to drive, introduction of cinemas and entertainment, modernization of the economy, building bridges with global capital markets. There's been so much good that has been done, but with that, there's been so much bad. And so while first and foremost, it's just a tragedy for Jamal and his family, it's also a tragedy for Saudi Arabia. If what is alleged is true, that he was dismembered and killed in a torturous manner, these are very un-Islamic principles. They're not given a Muslim burial. These are things that will strengthen extremists, ISIS, you know, Al-Qaeda type extremists, against not only Saudi Arabia, but its allies. And who is the ally that's standing most closely to Saudi Arabia today? The United States under Donald Trump. And so the White House may not realize it, but this could be leading to grave security risks for the United States.
One concern has been raised quite a bit is the president appearing comfortable in this situation and others in downplaying concerns about human rights abuses and not really talking much about the U.S. moral leadership that we have seen in the past and that we've come to understand as sort of our responsibility.
You know, I'm 50 years old now, but as a child growing up, by the way, both in the United States and in Saudi Arabia, you know, I can say that the role of the United States has always been, in my mind, I was always proud to be an American, not because of everything that we did, because we made so many mistakes, but because we saw ourselves as trying to be the city on the hill, the shining light, the beacon for democracy and freedom. And when we stop being that, when we abdicate our role of moral leadership, it engenders bad behavior around the world. He's not some radical. He was not some anti-Saudi campaigner. He was a loyal citizen who just wanted to see reforms take place at a faster pace. And if what is alleged is true, then what is clear is that the Saudi leadership wanted to send a chilling message to dissidents at home that don't you dare raise your voice. We will set the pace of reform. So with that, it's in doing that. So imagine that you are a domestic reformer in Saudi Arabia. When you see this happen to a Washington resident, a Washington Post reporter, what do you think is going to happen to you? So it's already sent chills, I think, through the hearts of many in Saudi Arabia.
Hadi Amr of the Brookings Institution speaking with our Laurie London. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. A dissident Vietnamese blogger known as Mother Mushroom has been released from prison and is now in the U.S. Pakistani authorities detained and then released human rights activist Gulali Ismail as she re-entered the country. China is defending its internment camps in Xinjiang province just weeks before China's human rights record comes up for review at the UN. And editors of major daily newspapers in Dhaka protested a new digital security law they say will stifle media freedom. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And VOA Asia continues. Two top officials in southern Afghanistan, including powerful police commander General Abdul Razik, have been killed in a shooting incident during a visit of the top U.S. general in Afghanistan. American General Scott Miller was unharmed. He was visiting the Kandahar governor's compound for a meeting with the governor and other provincial officials. In addition to Razik, Thursday's assault killed the provincial intelligence chief and badly wounded the Kandahar governor. VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim in Kabul tells VOA's Sarah Williams about the deadly assault.
It took place in Kandahar, and what we know so far is that General Scott Miller, who is the top U.S. general in Afghanistan, leading the U.S. and NATO forces, was in Kandahar for a high-level meeting with provincial officials, including the governor. And they were in the governor's compound, and when they were coming out of the meeting and going towards the helipad is when the shooting occurred. Now, the NATO spokesman has said that initial reports suggest it was an Afghan-on-Afghan attack, which indicates that somebody from maybe their own security contingent opened fire. The NATO spokesman also said that the attacker is dead and the area was secure and the American general was unharmed, but two American personnel were wounded and had been medically evacuated. Now, General Razik in this attack is killed, and he was a very influential man in southern Afghanistan. Some people might argue that he was one of the most influential and rich people of the area. People called him the secret kingmaker of southern Afghanistan. He was also the commander who had put, by some accounts and in the words of some people, fear in the hearts of Taliban. So he had secured Kandahar at a time when other provinces in Afghanistan are facing serious security threat. So his death would be a huge blow to the security situation in the area as well. And it will have impact on local politics because he was very influential in local politics.
Now, apparently General Razik had survived previous assassination attempts?
Yes, there had been several attempts on his life by the Taliban. He and the Taliban had been fighting each other for years. He became the commander of Kandahar police back in, I think, 2011, and since then, he had worked very hard to secure not just the main cities in Kandahar province, but also the outskirts of the cities and far-flung areas, which is, in Afghanistan, not very common. A lot of times you have secure cities, but you drive 1 hour outside the city and the areas under Taliban influence or control. So he had been at war with the Taliban for years.
This occurs as it seems that the general security situation in Afghanistan and in Kabul, where you are, has been in decline.
Yes, it has. And the Taliban, year after year, have been gaining ground and, you know, have been carrying out bigger and bigger attacks, including attacks inside cities like Kabul. And, you know, the last few big battles they had, like the one in Ghazni, hundreds of people died from both sides and, you know, a lot of civilians were impacted. This also occurs at a time when Afghanistan is ready to host a parliamentary election 2 days from now. So Saturday is the day when Afghans go to vote to choose their representative for parliament. And that is an event that the Afghan Taliban have already announced they're going to try and derail. And they've already told their followers to attack any election-related activities. So everybody's on guard and literally watching out, you know, on pins and needles to see what happens in the next 2 days in Afghanistan.
Happening now in Asia, Japan recorded a trade surplus for September of 139.6 billion yen, But still, exports fell 1.2% from the previous year, marking the first decline since 2006 after several natural disasters. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. And we're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. Despite a ruling last month from the Indian Supreme Court targeting a centuries-old tradition, Hindu groups have prevented women of reproductive age, approximately 10 to 50, from entering the Sabarimala temple in western Kerala states, prompting authorities to issue an emergency. Stone-throwing protesters clashed with police Wednesday and blocked roads and called for a strike on Thursday. The controversy comes amid a national debate over the rights of women in India. Rafiq Dasani is a senior economist and director of the Asia-Pacific Policy at the RAND Corporation. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that the High Court has sought to upend generations of religious practice.
Even older women, there were some liberalizations. So it was primarily the restrictions applied to women who were so-called between the ages of 10 and 50.
Why has this long-standing ban been in force?
For that, one has to go to the history of the temple, that it was a temple that is for the worship of a particular lord, you know. And according to the traditions of that worship in the sanctum sanctorum, which is around the icon, women have never been allowed, you know, or at least so it is believed.
Why did the Supreme Court rule the way it did?
So the Supreme Court responded to activists saying that this is not fair. And obviously, in today's day and time, you know, it isn't fair that women should be treated as excluded citizens. But then, you know, it's very hard. There are people, apparently within the protesters, there are even women saying that women should not be allowed.
These groups, these conservative Hindu groups, are defying the Supreme Court. What will happen next, do you think?
The law lays the onus on the state government to make sure that the Supreme Court's laws are fulfilled. And so state government is kind of helpless right now because politically, if it goes in there, if somebody dies in the protests against allowing women, there'll be a huge political price to pay.
There's already been violence at the site. Can negotiation possibly work?
I don't expect women to be allowed in this round of the festival. This is something that will only get resolved through negotiation over the next year. I think this one is gone because the government is not going to go in and force people out so easily. You know, it's too sensitive politically. So here you have a leftist government, a communist government in Kerala, which is sworn to live by the secular rule book. And now it's stuck facing a situation where it can't do anything. It's very politically nice for the national government to say, look, a communist government can't fulfill the law.
And of course, you've had all these reported rapes that have been going on. Is culture changing slowly in India, in your view?
Yes, I think it is. It's been well known for many, many years that, you know, women had very little power when men made sexual advances. But beginning a few years ago, there started to be cases filed on powerful men. You know, a journalist from a famous magazine, Tehelka, was imprisoned, and he's still in prison for what he did to a woman reporter. And now you have this going on. So I think it's a very encouraging sign that, and very courageous of the women concerned, given how backward India is in terms of social mores.
Rafiq Dasani said it's remarkable the number of Indian women who are going public with accusations of improper sexual behavior. He believes this underscores the many more women who have suffered the same fate but refuse to come forward.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
This news alert from VOA Asia. China's yuan fell to a 22-month low against the dollar after the U.S. Treasury declined to label Beijing a currency manipulator. Yuan fell to 6.9411 per dollar, recovered slightly in the afternoon. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. And VOA Asia continues. The International Organization for Migration reports the Rohingya refugee camps in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, are fertile grounds for traffickers who prey upon vulnerable people. It says young women and girls in particular are lured into situations of forced labor and sexual exploitation. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
An investigation by IOM staff has identified nearly 100 Rohingya refugees who have escaped abusive trafficking situations and returned to Cox's Bazar. The International Organization for Migration says these small numbers are only a fraction of those who have fallen victim to trafficking. It says it is difficult to pin down the scope and scale of this crime because of its clandestine nature. Also, it says victims are reluctant to come forward because of stigma and fear of retribution. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says girls sold into forced labor are the largest group of trafficking victims. But he says adult men and boys also are targets of traffickers, accounting for around 1 in 3 of those ending up in forced labor. He says traffickers lure vulnerable young people into dangerous situations with false promises of work and a better life.
Individuals mentioned instances of girls and young women recruited for domestic work or hotel maids and became trapped into forced prostitution. Community members stated Rohingya women normally did not consider prostitution as an income-generating activity, but the current lack of livelihood options forces some of the women to engage in survival sex.
Millman says the going price for cheap prostitution is $6, but the Rohingya women only get between 80 cents and $1.20 per service. Nearly 1 million refugees live in Cox's Bazar. Most have arrived since August 2017 to escape violence and persecution in Myanmar. IOM says the refugees are barred from leaving the settlements and depend entirely on international aid for survival. It says the limited work opportunities in the camps make the Rohingya easy prey for the traffickers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This news alert from VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump plans to nominate former Air Force General David Stilwell to be the State Department's top diplomat for East Asia, a post that has remained unfilled for more than a year, despite major challenges in the region. All the big stories coming your way every day on VOA. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis met Thursday with his Chinese counterpart in Singapore to, in the words of a Defense Department official, search for a more resilient military-to-military relationship amid a wide array of tensions. U.S. Secretary of Defense, Assistant Secretary of Defense Randall Shriver said the objective is to a less brittle relationship that could escalate into a catastrophic showdown. Robert Manning is a senior fellow in security at the Atlantic Council. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about the meeting.
Ironically, I think the most stable part of the relationship has been military to military. We have a number of agreements to avoid accidental events at sea, maritime, and air, and so on. They're still in the process of being improved and operationally, but more and more, China is a major maritime power, and we're operating in close proximity to them in the East China Sea and South China Sea. It's important that we have understandings about how we operate. And I think also that there's a lot of concern, of course, about Chinese assertiveness in the South China Sea. And we've been very counterassertive in running freedom of navigation operations just right around the 12-mile territorial limit of the islands that are in dispute that China has claimed and in some cases built military bases on.
Is it important that China requested this meeting?
Yeah, I think there's concern because we just had a major incident where a Chinese ship was within 45 feet of an American ship in the South China Sea. And so they need to work out better procedures and understanding on how to deal with these kinds of situations because they're going to happen more frequently. Our overall policy has gone, I think, a little too far to the extreme in the sense of the Vice President Pence's speech. Not that most of the grievances he laid out were accurate, but China is the second biggest economy in the world, the second biggest military in the world. and they're not going away, and we're not going away in the Pacific. And so we need to find a modus vivendi, at least at an operational level. And I think they may be a strategic competitor, but there are also a number of areas where, as the two major powers in the world, we have to work with them, whether it's climate change, counterterrorism, counter-narcotics. We're in a kind of a formative period of after a consensus on China policy has kind of been shattered by Chinese behavior, and I think still in the process of redefining it.
This meeting was supposed to take place in Beijing, but in the interim, the U.S. slapped some sanctions on China's military for buying weapons from Russia.
Yeah, that was another major source of contention, and the Chinese were very angry about that. This has become a big issue. The United States is implementing extraterritorial sanctions against a whole lot of people, and many cases certainly warranted, but you have to wonder what the long-term consequences of that are going to be.
So is this meeting in Singapore resetting U.S.-China mill-to-mill ties?
I think that's the intention, to try to get at least some new baseline to go from here.
Robert Manning of the Atlantic Council. Finally, during the fall season in the United States, pumpkin festivals are popular. They typically feature activities like wandering through a corn maze, going on a hayride, or picking a pumpkin off the vine. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to Butler's Orchard outside Washington, where people search for the perfect pumpkin.
The pumpkin theme is everywhere at Butler's Orchard in Germantown, Maryland. It has thousands of pumpkins, including a pumpkin patch where people can pick their own pumpkin. There are also other things to do, like riding a pony, plunging down a slide, or walking around a corn maze with its confusing winding pathways.
Every year, there's always one or two people that will call our farm market, our office, and say they're lost in the corn maze and they can't get out.
A hayride takes visitors to a large pumpkin patch. Some children discover the big orange fruits weigh more than they think.
That was really heavy.
Tristan Piazza plans to carve his pumpkin for Halloween.
I'm going to make the scariest face in the whole neighborhood.
The Butler family owns the 120-hectare farm. Visitors, in season, can pick their own fruits, vegetables, and flowers. Butler's Orchard opened more than 60 years ago as one of the first pick-your-own farms in the area. 89-year-old Shirley Butler and her late husband came up with the idea.
And it's a delight to go out on the farm, which I do a lot, and see the beautiful pumpkins in the field. I have people coming out of the field and thanking me for it, so it makes a fun time for everybody.
Ken Merriam brought his children.
I'm a kid at heart.
He says Butler's Orchard brings back good memories of growing up on a farm in Honduras.
It's a little bit of what I used to have as a kid, so that's why I think it's nice to bring them over here, get them out of the city.
Shirley Butler's grandchildren, who are in their 30s, are now the third generation to run the farm. General Manager Tyler Butler says children, who usually only see pumpkins in grocery stores, can learn how pumpkins are grown and tell Tyler.
I didn't know pumpkins came from a vine. There's flowers on this vine. There's roots.
These little girls are learning about pumpkins during their first trip to a pumpkin patch.
To feel, you know, the nature and the fruits.
For Tristan Piazza's mother, the fall festival is an annual event.
My parents have always brought me. I bring my kid now. I hope he stays in the area and he can bring his kids.
Since family farms are hard to keep afloat these days, Tyler Butler appreciates the tens of thousands of visitors who come to the fall festival each year. Deborah Block, VOA News, Germantown, Maryland.
Halloween's almost here. Well, that's our program for today and for this week. Thank you again so much for joining us. We'll be back with you again on Monday. We hope you will as well. And until then, have a great weekend.